Hello, welcome to a conversation about Beta X, or more particularly a conversation about design and sustainability. This evening I'm joined with, I'm not sure what the right phrase is yet, we'll find this out. The word that came to the tip of my tongue then was aspiring, but I kind of think you're not aspiring, you're past that point. So we're joined by Louis Heatley, Jack Cockle, Kyle Seago. Alan Foley. So I've known Louis for a while, and Louis's an avid poster onto LinkedIn about issues to do with design and sustainability. And I thought it'd be great to kind of bring you guys together to talk about the idea of what that means, what we think about are the values that drive this approach to design and sustainability, why it's different, and kind of what motivates you to, you know, what you're learning and where you hope it's going to go, and what's different about it as well. So what are the kind of clear markers that you hope to develop and show that you're developing for yourself? So the Beta X project, is a project in Leicester, which is about bringing together creative, I'm not really great at using that phrase, but a community of artists, makers, designers, researchers, thinkers and innovators, really with the mission of saying, how can we look at what design can do to improve our sustainable options? So it's everything from systems and urban design to life hacks to fashion to photography to communications to the whole range. And today I was at I popped in and recorded some audio for a podcast, and it was a group of kids making things with light, string fairy lights and boxes and paint and everything. It was amazing. It was really good. And it was kind of it's a space that brings people together, and it's not planned around major events. It's just lots of small events that, you know, bring about conversations. So hopefully that kind of paints a bit of a picture of what we're doing with Beta X. But do you want to, if I go round, I'll go clockwise on my screen. That's always the best way. So Kyle, you're next on my screen. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and what you kind of, how you've got into design and what kind of design it is?
Sure, yeah, no problem. So my name's Kyle Seago. I'm based in Somerset, and I currently work as a technician and a cover teacher at a secondary school. And alongside that, the four of us, the guys who are all here today, we run just a small startup design consultancy, or design collective, as we've called ourselves. We're just setting ourselves up, I guess, for we're just trying to set ourselves up for the future where we can lead sustainable design in a comprehensive way, something that other people can see and think, this is doable and we can do that. So whether or not that's us doing it and them learning from us, or us doing it for them, or them doing it with us, the goal is just to help transition to a more sustainable future. And that's in every single facet. That's from, like you said, from systems all the way to products, and just word of mouth. And that's I've kind of explained what we're doing there, not what I do, actually.
Well, that's okay.
We
can come back to that, don't worry. We'll, because one of the good things about this is it's kind of looking for examples and where we can say, how has it made a difference to do this and to start to tentatively do this. So, you know, a podcast is great for that because it allows us to do our thinking and explaining as we go along. Mm-hmm. Alan, how about you?
Oh, yeah. So I'm based down in windy Falmouth, down in Cornwall, at the moment. You know, met these guys, Jack, Louis, Kyle, studying the sustainable product design course down at Falmouth University. I sort of got into design just through school. You know, I was always a hands-on kid. You know, with my parents and stuff. I was always making bird boxes as a kid, and always outside doing gardening and DIY and whatnot with all Meccano. the sort of physical aspects of life always interest me a hell of a lot more than the academic side of things. So I sort of just naturally in school loved DT and food tech and, you know, photography, all that sort of stuff. Went to university, studied that. And now I work part-time in a lovely restaurant down at Falmouth to pay the bills. And then I'm currently setting up my own studio workshop, making space, focusing sort of green woodworking, sculpting and craft, making, you know, just really just admiring the natural physical products that you can make of greenwood, really. That's what I'm doing at the moment. And obviously the Sustainability Collective with the boys too.
Cool. So Jack, what about you?
Yeah, hi Rob, nice to meet you. I, like Aled said, we all went to uni together to do sustainable product design. I think in terms of the way I kind of got into design was when I was a kid, I loved to sort of draw things, and it'd be nothing specific, just sort of whatever came to me. And I used to sort of, I remember quite vividly thinking, oh, I'd love it if people made this, that sort of thing. I'd like the idea of people, of my ideas sort of coming to life. And I guess that sort of on a subconscious level was what drew me to design. And I also used to be quite fascinated by kind of seemingly quite silly things at the time, like the way that sort of deodorant can bottles would, you know, you'd twist the cap and it would like kind of rise up and present the sort of trigger, and, you know, things like that. I used to be kind of fascinated by, and then we went to uni, and I studied product design at GCSE and an A level, and then I met these wonderful people, and we bonded quite well throughout the 3 years, and so now we're starting the Sustainability Collective, and we're all very excited about that. But personally, at the moment, I'm a additive manufacturing engineer at a 3D printing company in Chorley. I live in Bolton, up near Manchester, at the moment, and that's been kind of something I've been nurturing for a while through from my second year of uni. Sort of got connected to this company, and they've been supporting my education throughout my undergraduate and postgraduate degree, and now I'm very lucky and privileged to have sort of slid quite neatly into a full-time job with them, which is really fascinating, and I get to see lots of cool stuff, and it's great. Thank you.
Hands-on stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So Louis, what about you? What's your journey been like?
My journey, you know, remarkably similar. It engaged with design and technology at school and got a love for it, and an enjoyment with engaging with sort of the materiality of things. And, you know, I think for lots of designers, there's a moment where it just clicks that everything man-made or most things that exist in our environment are designed and picked by a person, and all these decisions form the world that we live in. And I think that from that moment on, I decided I needed to do design because I wanted to engage with that world. I went down to Falmouth to study sustainable product design, which again, I bonded with these three, really enjoyed it. And then we sort of graduated during COVID, which was this whole event that the 3 years had been working up to had become a bit of a deflation, because it was the first summer after we'd sort of solved COVID for the first time. This graduation didn't happen. We all sort of just dispersed back at home, and things kind of carried on, as in people got jobs and people moved on. And it was about April last year when the four of us sort of got together and said, we're disappointed or frustrated with the things that we're interacting with and seeing. So Aled's worked for Tom Raffield, And I'm currently working as a product designer in a research and development department at a design consultancy in Leicester. And there's lots of frustration that we found with the way that the current business is set up. So that's where we started this sustainability collective, which is something we wanted to do from the beginning. But we've decided we're going to do this in our own time, and we're going to do it properly in a sort of 100% sustainability, try and just do it perfectly without compromising morals. And I'm sure there's a point where we're going to need to, but we've not reached it yet. And so we're engaging with live projects and we're enjoying that. But that's sort of my origin leading up to this point. And one of the things I really like about the four of us working on it together is we all do different things and engage differently with materials. You've got Aled, who works with greenwood a lot and really enjoys that. And Jack works with 3D printing. And it's complete opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of, you know, materiality and physicality and craft and high precision engineering. And I think that we all fit along that variety, that sliding scale. It's really engaging to work on projects with them. And that's quite, again, one of the nice things about design is that you've got this huge scale and this realm and this breadth of things that are made by people that it's just fun to engage with, and there's so many avenues for engaging, and that's what got me into design, and I've been hooked since.
At the hub today we had a blacksmith. It was like they had a cabin and portable furnace and stuff, and we're talking about the kind of shift away from physical, you know, tangible objects that you design to virtual screens, and you're saying you can't do metalwork on AutoCAD in that way, and people kind of walk up to them and say, oh, don't you have a 3D printer that does that now? He says, well, do you want to come and try and bash the metal? It was great. Yeah, it was really good. So I've got two immediate questions that come to mind, and in a sense, if we can kind of explain you thinking about this, and I don't know what order to take it in, and I don't just jump in, you know, there's no order for this. So what's your idea of what sustainability is, and what's your idea of what design is? And if we keep them separate to begin with, then we can think about, how do these come together in kind of practice? Because as ideas and concepts, they're not straightforward. How do you find when you mention, you know, design for sustainability, that you, what's your reaction with people? Is it kind of welcoming, or is it blank faces?
I'd like to jump in and answer the first question, because we were talking about just the other day. So I think on a hopefully collective level, we at least me personally, we define design as a series of intentional decisions informed by research or experience or a mix of the two, in order to produce solutions to problems, no matter sort of how big or small they are. And a lot of the time this is sort of informing very visual and physical elements of our world, so products and graphics and things like this. But there's also certain authors who have written books about kind of using design thinking within other aspects of society as well. But I guess on a sort of base level, it is more about the way that things function and designing products, and that before you can then sort of build to understand how it can help in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Design as a process is a conscious decision.
When it comes to sustainability, I guess the simplest explanation or summary is to meet the needs of the current generation without impeding on the needs of the next or continued generations. But it's the actual contextualization of that and the application of that, where things then get incredibly complex and personal, and it's things like sustainability while having the same root concept has lots of different methods of application and results that come from it in a way that it would be difficult to summarize everything under the symbol, a single umbrella. And there's lots of thought processes on the matter that vary in scale from micro to macro, from redesigning the economy to enable things that actually value human development rather than just blankly looking at GDP, to things that just improve air quality in a room. There's loads of ways that you can interpret sustainability. Because the
danger is it just becomes a catch-all for everything, doesn't it? You know, it's like I use the word community a lot, and I'm trying to move away from that because everybody just says, oh, the community. And it's like, well, who are you talking about? And I've started to say people and groups of people because yeah. it identifies it, these specific people with these specific needs. So we've got a lot more we can kind of dig into with these two concepts. The interesting one about the design intent, I suppose it raises the question for me, what do we mean by intent? So I don't want to get into kind of even like a deep philosophical roots for this, you know, but you mentioned, somebody mentioned authors and books that you read and music and I suppose art and culture. Tell us a bit about what drives and where does that model, what is your model of intent? You know, what kind of tells you about, how do I put it? It's kind of the way the world is. What's informed you of what the world is? So, I mean, even just as simple as kind of like, what do you listen to? What are you listening to at the moment? What do you draw value from when you're working? You know, what kind of conversations you like? What are the places you like to go to where you think that's nourishing me and it's informing me, but you're not quite sure what it is about, you can't yet put your finger on it. Is that too vague to answer, or is that, yeah? You know, because I'm from a different generation, and you know, my intent is informed by a whole set of different cultural factors and markers and practices and things like that. And we need to get the idea with Beta X is to get into that emergent, that new, that kind of flow of ideas that tap into this.
I think you've got to give credit to the internet for the dispersion of information, because there's so many platforms with wide ranging, almost towards holistic views around things that exist in the world, things that are happening. And we live in a time where the moment that there's an oil spill, you can hear about it around the globe. And so there's lots of platforms and really, really good organizations engaging with this and spreading information. Earthrise Studios are really good. Atmos is a magazine that's really, really just informative and insightful. And I think that lots of us are experiencing the things that are wrong that currently happen through the news and these outlets, but also things that are worth working towards. And this what you might bluntly describe as inspiration, or sort of the positive world we're working towards. There are areas around the world that are doing it and taking steps towards this and constructing futures that are positive and bring us towards them. So I think that's quite a large influencer on the way that we engage with things, because, for example, within industrial design, you have a supply chain that stretches tens of thousands of miles, and it's impossible to ever experience that fully in any physical sense, but without much physical exertion on our part, we can perceive the impacts, or at least some of the impacts, if not definitely not the full impacts, but we can begin to develop an understanding of the impacts of international supply chains through this medium that brings us a foot away from someone in half a second.
Yeah, harping like on harping off the sort of generational thing, we've entered just the sort of world of design, and just in our lives as well. You know, when growing up, we were subjected to the rise of Web 2.0, and everything was completely accessible to us. You know, world news, information, it was all instant. You know, if you wanted any sort of information, we could find it easily. And with everything being so open to us on social media, I think especially for myself, really, if you're aware of it, and you really have to be proactive in, you know, doing your own research and finding out the information for yourself instead of falling into trap of just what gets force fed to you. And I think you can, when you talk about sort of intent and design, it sort of goes hand in hand. You know, when you're designing a product, you can't just go for the first easy thing that's as accessible to you.
Who are the people that you look to as inspirational? I mean, I don't, you can take that too far. I'm never very well. I don't like this idea of picking role models, and you know, you kind of need to push past some of these things, burn your bridges sometimes. But yeah, if you want to answer it on the basis of who you're inspired by, that's great. But if you want to answer it on the basis of who you detest and you think should be, you know, kind of buried deep underground, something like that, please feel free. But you know,
who should, too political.
Well, who should we be looking to, and who do you kind of use as your reference points to say this is somebody that is clued or has been in the past, has been clued in, or if we reappraise what they do and the circumstances that they did it in, we can really kind of see the, you know.
I'm just going to jump in straight away and say we need to listen to the science and the truth and not sit back and slip into ignorance and stay set in our ways. We need to just listen and be proactive and try to do the right thing based on what the facts are telling us.
In terms of role models, though, I think it's quite difficult to...
Yeah, that's what I was... Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite difficult to pin down.
You can't rely on what people have done in the past. We've got to be proactive and just... Because everything's changing constantly.
And I definitely think we've talked before about the kind of psychological impacts of idolizing people and... the fact that we're all sort of, it's difficult because several people, not just Johnny Ive, for example, will have contributed to the design of the iPhone.
Obviously, namely, you know, sort of pioneers of sort of sustainable design thinking and stuff like that was like Viktor Papanek.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And McDonough and so Braungart.
And Michael Braungart.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. It's just like they obviously were, of their time, so ahead of the design thinking of anyone else, even in today. Definitely. Like the stuff they're talking about then, so much has progressed and the world has changed so much in the past couple of decades.
And even
some of the stuff they talk about isn't overly relevant. So when it comes to like authors and designers from the past, you've really got to, like, you know, like Dieter Rams and stuff, the people idolize designers that have the whole minimal aesthetic and his, like, you know, the 10 principles of good design and whatnot. But you really got to be, you know, as you said, you can't be too careful into idolizing and falling, you know, just living what they were teaching, because it was done you know, relatively a long time ago now. We've just got to take what they said with a pinch of salt and make our own modern
Well, that's kind of one of the distinctions about kind of postmodernism, and before that, modernism was very much about kind of postmodernism. You just had to adopt a style and a posture, and you know, you could play with that. But it kind of, that's as far as you really took it. It was kind of the artifice of it, and yeah, there's a great skill in that, but it doesn't kind of go beyond that presentation of a kind of a stylistic stance, if you like.
Yeah, I definitely think that if I were to pick absolutely anyone, I just remember being on my summer holiday. I think I was in Croatia with my family, and we we were given reading to do before the course. And I remember reading McDonough and Braungart's Cradle to Cradle, rethinking the way we make things. All of the four of us can agree that we think it's kind of, we like to think of it as sort of the sustainable design Bible,
yeah, almost, Bible,
because it's such it just presents such kind of, I'm not sure if radical is the right word, but just such interesting sort of mind-blowing ideas that, I'd never really thought about before at that point, because sustainability at school wasn't really a massively taught part of the curriculum. But that was just it was just brilliant, and it really well written as well.
Yeah, sort of it's a perfectly accessible book.
Yeah, anecdotal. They don't throw complicated language at you. It's a really easy to read book, as well as being incredibly informative. And I hate using the word eye opening, but yes, that sort of thing.
It's a perfect sort of entry book, you know. When it's, as you said, it was written in such a fantastic way. Some of Victor Papanek's stuff, it can be, you know, you'd have to reread the whole page to sort of try and wrap your head around what's been said. Mm. But with Cradle to Cradle, I'd highly recommend anyone, even if you're not overly into design or sustainability. It's such a fantastic book to read, and it really just it completely changes the way you think things and see things. After reading that book alone, just as sort of like the sort of first steps into sustainability. You know, you won't look at a computer mouse the same ever again.
When things are like that, they can provide a really powerful idea of these futures to work towards. And we need people to construct these future paradigms of the way that we behave sustainably, and stories that encourage this behavior. I think that we've found there to be a tendency to consider sustainability separate to reality in the process of doing product design. It's because lots of the ways that it's currently enacted on can be very clunky. So one of the major tools, and I'm not denying it's a major tool, for increasing the sustainability, is to perform LCAs and life cycle analysis. But that alone won't create solutions to the climate emergency that we're living in, because these are programs that just provide a number in response to something that you've already done and spec'd. And lots of things that happen within the design process don't follow that as a process. They're there throughout. So stylizing is there throughout, and the idea of ergonomics should be there throughout. But this sustainability has the process where sometimes it's just put in, and that's not going to produce holistically sustainable solutions. And so you've got lots of companies which are performing LCAs, and it's good that they are beginning to understand these numbers, but that won't provide solutions. And sustainability is often critiqued in comparison to cost and to profit margins. And these ideas that are somewhat damaging. There's the economist Kate Raworth, who wrote the book Donut Economics, which talks about creating the circular economy. And there's the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, which talks a lot about it and promotes the circular economy, and I'd fully recommend it. And what Kate Raworth does in her book is she breaks down where the idea of GDP came from as a measure for our own success, and the success initially being based off the improvement in human life and human quality and social foundations. But we're finding, or we found, that there's this correlation that has been purported to exist doesn't necessarily exist. So as the GDP increases, it was claimed that your quality of environment would worsen and then improve. But that's because as the GDP increases, lots of countries outsource manufacture. You're not improving the quality of manufacture. You're actually just punishing other countries as they go through this. And so we're operating in an economic model where sustainability will always be second to an accountant. And that doesn't make sense. That doesn't actually work when you've got a planet of 7 billion people with, you know, the top 50% taking 90% of the resources of the emissions providing.
So what's your sustainability model then? So you've identified as a really great critique of the kind of inherited thinking about production. But production is different from sustainability. And sustainability, as we've kind of said earlier, is one of those nebulous words that doesn't really mean very much. So what are you hoping to define? What's your working definition? You know, you're working with clients, you go into people and you're saying, actually, this is what you've got to think and you've got to think differently. What's that model that you've got in your mind that's bubbling through?
The circular economy is that model. It's the idea that we operate with resources that don't degrade over time and don't degrade over use, and that we have the reclamation of these materials. And lots of places are promoting the circular economy and utilizing it. So Amsterdam has declared the circular economy to be their COVID recovery model. And that's the way they're going to recover from COVID and create an economy that is more less susceptible to economic deviation. So having these impacts from external sources. So that is likely the core of what we're doing. But then you need to also engage across the supply chain with all of the stakeholders, all of the shareholders in that, because we're used to interacting with products for the amount of time that they have value to us and getting rid of them. And it's entirely the role of the designer to consider in a systems level manner, from the moment that resource might come out of the ground or be separated from a tree, right to the point where it rejoins that cycle.
I think robust might be, you know, in the sense that less likely to be overwhelmed by instability is, yeah, one way of thinking about it. But that can become robustness can become a tyranny. So what examples would you point to that kind of give you that, retain that creative flexibility?
Let's start with BrewDog, who are a really, really good company for it because they're a fun one. They're taking...
We love beer.
Yeah. They're taking their grain waste that would normally just be biological waste that goes to be turned into fertilizer or whatever end of life that they previously had for it. Yeah. And they are making that into a distilled drink. So without actually increasing their intake of raw materials, they're adding another process to this idea of circularity to improve their product range, to do things that would make them more robust as a company by having that extra product without that impact. We're working with, at the moment, on a live project with a company called Waterhall, who get material from the oceans, and they take that and they turn that into products. So we're currently redesigning their litter picker, which is part of so it's made in the UK. And we're redesigning that to be more ergonomic, because while the focus of that was on taking the material that's being introduced into the circular process, there was a bit of a mismatch on the actual interaction with people.
I think we define the, like, very in a brief summary, the circular economy as being a model where waste doesn't exist, because everything that can, any sort of waste that results from the dispose of a product can then be turned into something new, which makes that waste a resource, therefore eliminating the idea of waste altogether. One of my favorite things is within the 3D printing industry, at least, is so there's this company in the US, and they've managed to harness a technology called binder jetting, which includes the precise placement of adhesive, some sort of adhesive, to print objects out of a powdered material. One of the things that they can do with this, and that they are doing with this, is they've been developing 3D printable wood from sort of waste sawdust, for example. And what they can do with this is they take the lignin, so the resin from the actual wood itself, they separate it from the sawdust, and then they use the lignin, the original resin from the wood, to bind the wood back into a controllable form, and which can then biodegrade, or, you know, it can be used, and then at the end of its life, it can biodegrade, or you can, you know, use the same process to make something else. I just think that's so awesome, because it's such a raw kind of, you know, you're not adding anything to it that has to be separated in order to, for those materials to return to the natural environment. You're just processing that material from waste into a usable product.
That is about as perfect as it gets, isn't it, in the circular economy?
Yeah.
What a beautiful example.
So yeah, exactly. And the idea of disposal doesn't have to, the only reason it's currently not particularly good is because we're thinking of going away isn't going away. It's just moving to a different place, and it's not, then we're not designing things to return back into either the technological or the environment or the natural cycles. We're just sort of putting it somewhere else. So the idea of disposal isn't the problem. It's the fact that we're not making things that can fit in. So if you design something that's disposable and that you only use for a certain period of time, the answer isn't making things that can last forever, that you keep forever and you never throw away. The idea is making things in a way that bonds to its contextual use. So if you need it to last forever, make it so it lasts forever. But if you need it, then design it so that it can return to this either cycle with minimal effort that doesn't harm the environment in any way.
One of the big myths, fallacies about recycling, certainly here in the UK, is that, you know, I assiduously fill my recycling bags up, but it gets imported, you know, exported to India or something like that, and it's like, and you're not really dealing with the root problem.
Exactly.
And there's a danger that it just becomes what's the phrase, a greenwash over things to give it the semblance of sustainability, when in actual fact, in order to demonstrate that you're somehow, it's like electric cars. Actually, over the life cycle of an electric car, they're going to be more damaging than petrol engines. And you know, you look at it in its holistic view. Mm. What's the kind of culture change that you think we want to see? Where does, I think, Kyle, you mentioned before about things, sustainability not being on the school curriculum. What would you like to see in that respect in the school curriculum?
Just from start to finish, from bottom to top, needs to be taught, because there's not enough people.
What would be the main things that you'd ask them to consider?
Well, materials to start. The way the materials are joined together in DT, this is, I would say, the way that the materials are joined together. Just an awareness. Just build an awareness of what it is they're doing, and that everything they produce, or that we produce, has an impact, and the goal isn't necessarily to make that impact zero, because we don't live in a perfect world, but to just reduce that impact as much as possible. And I think the way to do that is by making sure that they do it from the youngest age. And I said this the other day to the boys that the main thing that I learned whilst I was at university wasn't these tangible skills, you know, these sustainable design practices like lightweighting and using biodegradable materials and stuff like that. It wasn't that. What it was is just the ability to stop, slow down, take a step back and think, what is the impact of this, of what I'm about to do or what I'm thinking of doing? And by doing that and having that sort of that wall that you have to climb or step over, it allows you to then work out what the solution is to that problem before you do it. And we don't have that in other facets of society, unfortunately. And the answer to that is education right from the start.
But many of us have our heads to the, you know, faces to the grindstone, don't we? And we're kind of racing around trying to get stuff done and just kind of live our lives. Some of these matters become secondary. Alad, what's your kind of, in the work that you do, you talked earlier about setting up a studio, you know, it's kind of it's a different kind of space that you create.
So when you're talking earlier about the whole, you know, recycling stuff, the general lifestyle that we live these days is a very much one of convenience and fast. And we just want things to be easy for us because life is hard and ease is quite nice. And when you talk about recycling, you know, we just export it and ship it elsewhere in a very out of sight, out of mind, quite a British sort of way of thinking about things. You know, it's not our problem. You know, once it's shipped elsewhere, we've recycled. The people at home, the consumers, they've all done their bit and they put the recycling in the correct bags and whatnot. And I think that's another fundamental problem, where it's just the sort of ownership of responsibility in terms of that sort of question you posed earlier. But so for me though, in the sort of work that I like to do, it's the complete opposite of what Jack loves, the sort of the additive manufacturing, rapid prototyping, such a technical modern process, whereas what I sort of do with the green woodworking, which is the oldest style of woodworking sort of known to mankind, also known as bodging and whatnot. You don't use power tools, it can be handmade, no sort of electricity required. It's quite interesting to see those two things on the same scale in terms of when people think about sustainability. Obviously the first one people always think of is environmental, but with this sort of the three main pillars of sustainability, which is sort of social, economic, and environmental.
Louis, what kind of comes to mind with me with this? Are you trying to marry two distinct ethos? As we talked about intent before, you've got there's almost a romanticism to what Alan's just been talking about, and you've got this kind of industrial process which Jack maybe represents, and then you've got this Alan represents this kind of romantic kind of pre-industrial process, and it's kind of it's about respecting both in the same and not trying to choose one against the other. It's just learning from each other.
It's choosing which is the best one for what you're making, I guess.
What it is taking a bullet train to a town made of wooden houses. That's what it is. And there is what appears to be a disconnect in the idea of sustainability, because we have been, Viktor Papanek talks about design and humanity's self-image as being domination over nature, that we see ourselves as separate from nature, which is represented in the way that we talk about ourselves as not being animals, that we view ourselves as rational economic beings when we're definitely not. And so there is almost this weird disconnect, but the ideas of a sustainable future is a progress that is not determined by this idea of domination over nature. So it's using lower impact solutions such as renewable energy, which has an investment in cost, but it's a damn sight better than burning rocks you found in the ground.
Yeah.
And electric cars have their own emissions when they're being created, but it reduces the impact of emissions in built-up environments. And it isn't the only solution, because it's active transport as well. So it's people cycling to places with less cars on the road. It's building resilient train networks so that people can actually get between spaces. It's things as small as Google planning routes should be able to incorporate taking a bike on a train, right? The fact that it doesn't has this weird disconnect from people's lives. You're either taking public transport or you're not. And that's one that encourages things like cars to be perceived as this ultimate mode of transport, because the interconnectedness of these systems aren't quite there. And it's one of the things the internet can enable. But I definitely agree with your point, and that there does appear to be this disconnect between technological and romantic. But it's because we've perceived and continued on a path where it's infinite growth, it's domination over nature, it's separating things from nature and the things that actually construct them. And it's something that we need to readdress, and it is being readdressed in sustainability and building these large scale, for example, large scale corporations that can't work or interact on a local level. We want to move away from that, and we need to move away from that to things that can respond to the local environment, because actually head office 300 miles away will not know whether a Greenwood craftsperson will make a better chair than one that's mass produced, and they're not able to get that distinction. So we need to be able to accompany these ideas that we've been taught are directly opposed to one another when they're not.
And that craft-produced Greenwood chair is going to be valued more over its lifetime than a disposable, cheap IKEA product that just gets thrown out.
And when we're talking about disposable, what we're referring to is disposable as an economic concept, not as a sustainable one. And it's been sort of owned by an economic model, where actually things are only called disposable and it's only justified because they're economically disposable. And it's because we're using an economic system that doesn't account for the impact that we're having on resources and the planet.
I thought of a question to kind of wrap this up with, which is, because you were all reluctant to say who you would kind of regard as, if you like, your kind of points of inspiration. Maybe think about where. If you could go and work anywhere, where would you want to go and work? You know, who mentioned the Netherlands earlier or something like that? So it's kind of where, if your freedom of movement was unencumbered by any kind of bureaucracy, or you had a really good sponsor, where would you like to go and base yourself? Maybe not on the basis of where they're doing things already, but on the basis of where maybe the challenges are that you think you could contribute towards.
I think it's safe to say that we've all got one answer for that, and it's all the same answer.
Maybe.
Do you all want to say it at the same time, just to see if this works? Oh, God.
We just think Cornwall, and not specifically Falmouth, but possibly Falmouth is where we'd like to be. Not just as a design consultancy, but as individuals.
Alan, what's in the water in Falmouth that's so attractive for everybody?
A lot of salt. I think it's sort of thing I don't even think it's like an international based one. So I don't know if, you know, you could say you want to go out to sort of less developed countries and show them the right way, you know, not to follow the Western world's path and go down the most destructive way to develop as a country. But definitely sticking at home in the UK, the UK is nowhere near perfect. It's anywhere far from being perfect in terms of sustainability. And I think definitely it'd be amazing to be sort of leading the way in design and pioneering the UK in sustainability. But location-wise, as we're doing right now, we all four of us live in four separate parts of the UK, and we're still trying our damn best to do it.
Together would be the best. because it's by working together, we're able to have a bigger impact than on our own. And that's definitely one of the concepts of sustainability, is society and acting as a community, because they are more resilient. And if there's one thing that you can do to encourage more sustainability, it's reintroduce this idea of society, which isn't dead, and this idea of community. For example, if you start a WhatsApp group or a Messenger group, other services are available for your street, you can half at the least the amount of lawnmowers you have. The idea of a street, it's together is where we would like to be. And we're doing it, we're being together through the internet at the moment, and we find inspiration together through the internet. But together would be the response to where we can be. And wherever anybody is trying to make a sustainable difference, if they're together with more people, that's the only way it can be done.
Because sustainable we're on hive this. Mind.
Because, yeah, because we're on this, we're it's everyone and it's everything. And that's,
yeah. That's we all have to work together.
To be addressed.
It's a much better answer than mine.
Yeah. Come on, where the bee is better.
Like, oh, go for a geographical location, and Louis's like,
well, well, it's the sort of thing is, you know, you can't, we need to stop working against each other as sort of companies working against each other to succeed more than one another. Because, you know, as Leo was saying earlier, we're now somehow so detached from nature that humanity is now something completely separate. When, you know, everyone says it, you know, once humanity's gone, Mother Nature will still prevail eventually. But it's the sort of thing that, yeah, we just have to work together. Everyone has to work together for the betterment of the world and henceforth mankind, really.
Kyle, any last thoughts?
Louis summarized it beautifully.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jack, any last thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't really the sort of answer I was thinking of, or else I would have said the same thing, because I think in terms of us as people, as like friends, I think we'd rather be together anywhere than somewhere. Like, I'd rather be with this lot, like anywhere, than me being in Cornwall alone. It's not about it's not about the location per se, but even though our friendship started there, and that's the place we love, and that obviously enriches it. But yeah, like if we're going down that route, absolutely, because
I think Cornwall is one of the last untouched parts of England by the heavy hand of capitalism. I think it's the poorest. It's the poorest.
One of the poorest.
The poorest, yeah.
It is the poorest.
It is.
County in England. And I think what's going to happen is Cornwall's going to go, rather than following the rest of England, Cornwall's going to break away and be a leader in sustainability and economic strength through sustainability. I think Cornwall's going to be the sustainable Silicon Valley of the UK. Yeah.
There's definitely lots of sort of SMEs and things down there that are focused on sustainability and community.
There's such a fantastic sort of community around. There's so many organisations based down here in Cornwall that are just doing fantastic work. And because as Carl, you know, everyone jokes about Cornwall being 40 years behind everywhere else. And the main reason people move to Cornwall is because it is so much slower and it hasn't got that fast, active, modern sense of life that people have in a city where you're always just trying to, on your own path, you're always trying to succeed. There's such a lovely sense of, I know you said you didn't like the word community earlier, such a lovely sense of community down in Cornwall, but everyone's sort of, you know, it's just a harsh, it's like, it's just nature focused. It feels very nature focused down here.
And we were talking earlier about the difference of dreaming about sustainability and being grounded in the reality of how it exists. However, having said that, I think we all, since I think probably second year at university, we've all dreamed of, well, at least now, of being there. And as the four of us, and probably more in the future, we'd like to have a sort of, that's where we want to be based as a consultancy. And we'd like to almost be sort of a hub for sustainability and within the community, not as a kind of closed
independent business.
Exactly.
Louis brought you all together, so I'm going to give Louis the last word. And for a discussion for a project called Leicester Beta X, what would you sum up then in terms of, you know, the allure for you of Cornwall? Kind of, you're based in Leicester, close to Leicester. What would you say really needs to be taken from that? Because that's the magic, isn't it? To try and bring that together, that desire.
It's the sense of community that exists there. And it's something that you can generate in your local environment. And it's a little, it's not a loud thing. It's a profound and quiet thing. And it's as simple as sending a message. And if you just need to borrow something once rather than buy it, you've negated the entire emissions of a single object. And we are social creatures that benefit from things that where we interact with other people. And it's why things like the BetaX project is so useful for creating these hubs, because it starts with one and you get more and they get more permanent. And as informal or as formal as you like, we need these community and local based infrastructures that will allow us to become more resilient, lead better lives that are more fulfilling, and give us something to work for as well, so that we're not focusing on ourselves as individuals and sorting ourselves out. And we see that idea of society and community is both important, worth trying for, and a valuable tool in of itself for generating a more sustainable and just better future. Just less pollution and less defining yourself based on income and defining our own identity in our separation to nature, because it's something that is rewarding and fulfilling.
Is there a Twitter address or Instagram feed?
No,
or
we have not social media. Yet. We can do shout outs instead.
No, well, what I'll do is that is I'll put links to each of your LinkedIn profiles or something like that.
That sounds fantastic.
So just a chance to say thanks very much for coming together with this. And
thank you.
And any feedback, I'm sure we'll feed back to you. So
awesome. Yeah, thank you.